And now I'm going to introduce you to the chair of this evening's program, Jacob Foster. Jacob Foster is an attorney at Kasowitz, Benson, Torres, and Friedman in San Francisco. Mr. Foster previously served in the office of the Chief Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. He'll moderate and be in conversation with David Kay, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, and he's the author of the HRC 2015 report on encryption and anonymity in the digital communications. So please join me in welcoming Jacob Foster.
Thank you, Linda. Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jacob Foster, an attorney at Kasowitz, Benson, Torres, and Friedman, LLP, and your chair for today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. David Kay is a professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, and the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression. His report to the UN Human Rights Council on the use of encryption and anonymity in digital communications concluded that encryption enables individuals to exercise their rights to freedom of opinion and expression in the digital age, and as such merits strong protection. The report has been described in the media as groundbreaking, a landmark, and hugely influential on a vibrant political debate that is currently occurring all around the world. Please join me in welcoming David Kay.
Thanks, Jacob. So thank you all for being here. I think maybe what I should do, because the title that I have is a little unwieldy and a little, I mean, if your title has special in it, it sounds a little obnoxious. Maybe I'll say a couple of words about the framework of human rights at the UN level, and I'll try to keep that pretty brief, and then spend a few minutes talking about the subject matter really is, and that's national security and freedom of expression. And really, when we say national security and freedom of expression, I'm referring to how national security is used to undermine freedom of expression around the world. So let me first say a few words about what it means to be a special rapporteur, that kind of title that gets my kids' eyes rolling at me. So the central human rights body of the United Nations is the Human Rights Council. It's actually a part of the General Assembly. The Human Rights Council consists of about a little less than 50 states, 50 governments, and they do a number of things. They review other states' human rights practices. They adopt resolutions on different human rights issues around the world. And they also have something called special procedures. So the Human Rights Council appoints different, we'll say, experts to monitor different areas of human rights around the world. And there are about 50 who are either special rapporteurs, as I am, so individuals who focus on a particular area, or working groups. And there's a handful of working groups that focus on areas. So for special rapporteurs, I focus on freedom of opinion and expression. There's also freedom of assembly and association, freedom of human rights defenders, a new rapporteur on privacy, and I could go down a list, and that's just the civil and political rights-oriented rapporteurs, and there are also those who focus on economic, social, and cultural rights. Human rights at the international level tends to be divided between economic, social, and cultural rights, housing, education, and so forth, and civil and political rights, expression, political engagement, and so forth. So I was appointed about a year and a half ago, a little over a year and a half ago, to take on this role. And at the time, it was pretty clear, as it's been clear for several years, that there's a range of threats to freedom of expression around the world, and that many of them tend to focus on or hinge upon arguments about national security. So I want to talk a little bit about how national security is used, I would say abused, around the world at a global level, and then talk a little bit about the how it's abused in the West, and how that's really a problem as we try to expand human rights protections around the world. I mean, really what we do in the West has a real impact, and it's not just a rhetorical impact, it's actually having a real impact on policies that are adopted around the world. So first, let me start with a little global overview. And to give a little footnote here, the way that we as rapporteurs work in the human rights system at the UN level is we report to the Human Rights Council on a variety of issues. So I'll report, obviously all within freedom of expression, I'll report on communications that I receive from human rights defenders around the world, and we in turn report directly to governments. So we will raise allegations with governments about violations of freedom of opinion, freedom of expression. And those get reported to the Human Rights Council. I also do thematic reporting. So as Jacob mentioned, our report on encryption and anonymity was a thematic report, almost like a law review kind of article, not quite as, not quite as dull as a law review article, hopefully. law review articles also must be read. So we do thematic reporting, do the sort of communications with governments, and also country visits. So a couple of weeks ago, I was in Tajikistan, which is in Central Asia and has a 1,500-kilometer border with Afghanistan, and I'll talk about that as an example in a moment. Okay, so that was just a little bit of sort of the scene setting. One of the things that we've seen, not just over the last couple of years, but historically really, is how governments use national security to undermine freedom of expression. So that actually, under the freedom of expression as a human right, is a legitimate basis for restriction. Right, so under human rights law, everybody enjoys, and this is actually one of those rare human rights treaties to which the United States is a party. We're bound by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. This is also language from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everybody enjoys the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers. So it's kind of a transboundary, right? It's my right to get information from another country, through any media, including art. It's a pretty remarkable right to a certain extent. And even though, as you'll see in the restrictions, it's narrower to a certain extent than our own First Amendment law, it's broader in the sense that it refers to everybody's right to freedom of expression rather than posed in the negative as First Amendment law is, which is Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera. So what we've seen over the last couple of years is states using the restrictions under human rights law. And the restrictions are as follows. So even while everyone has the right to freedom of expression, states are permitted under human rights law to restrict that freedom of expression where it's provided by law, so there's an existing law, and it's a necessary restriction in order to protect a legitimate interest. And one of those legitimate interests that's named in Article 19 of the covenant that I mentioned is national security. So public order, national security, and a couple other areas. States increasingly use that restriction on national security in order to restrict freedom of expression. And we see it in a few different ways. We see it in terms of censorship. So countries quite regularly simply restrict websites, restrict newspapers. There's an interesting case from a couple of months ago where there was a report in Thailand in the International New York Times about corruption in Thailand. And the entire front page, basically, of the New York Times, the International New York Times in Thailand, was redacted. So if you got the paper, you would see sort of a blank space. The reason, we actually don't know. The government of Thailand didn't explain it why this was. It's likely that they would have said public order or national security for reasons probably that don't have much to do with the actual reporting. But we see a lot of censorship around the world. We also see, particularly in a digital age, we see states requiring telecom operators, so either your ISPs or your phone company, requiring them to take down the internet, whether taking down service entirely, So bringing down the internet, I mean, this has happened repeatedly in Central African Republic, in Burundi, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, so in several other places in Africa, also in Tajikistan, and in a number of places in Central Asia, where on grounds of national security, the state will say, we're ending service for this period of time. Maybe it's in the lead up to an election, maybe it's during a public assembly, a public protest, and it's something that we see pretty in a pretty common way. It's happening all the time. So these kinds of things are happening. There's also law on the books around the world related to defamation. So criminalizing defamation, where you defame a government official, right? So in Thailand, sorry to pick on Thailand. In Thailand, it's called Lèse Majesté laws, where you can't insult the king. Many of you might have heard about that. But it's increasingly used as a tool to undermine criticism of government officials and really to undermine criticism generally of government policy. Okay, so those kinds of things are happening at the global level, and increasingly the threat of terrorism is used as the reason to do that. So what's the connection to what's happening in the West? So one of the things we've seen over the last, I would say, year to year and a half, but has really picked up quite a bit of momentum in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo shootings in Paris, the killings in Paris, January of last year, has been states in the West adopting rules that are really strongly undermining freedom of expression. And we see them in a bunch of different ways. So one way that we see it is in terms of content restriction. So we'll see, for instance, in France, the criminalization of the glorification of terrorism. Nobody really likes terrorism to be glorified, but you know, what does that actually mean? Well, it means a variety of things, and it probably isn't very well defined. It's not very well defined in French law. It's not very well defined in European law. But increasingly, you see that kind of restriction on glorification of terrorism across Europe. You see it in Spain as well, and you see it in other places. So that's one kind of content restriction that is on its face based on counterterrorism and national security, but it's also often used, particularly in the context of emergency laws that have been imposed in France since the awful shootings, the massacres of November in Paris, used really to shut down public discussion of terrorism. It's happening in particular in minority communities, so in Muslim communities in France, but it's an issue that whether it's being imposed and implemented in ways that might be narrow or not, it's giving a signal to those outside of liberal democratic states that this is the kind of restriction that's acceptable. So that's one example, sort of the increasing content restrictions that we see across Europe. A second is related more to surveillance. So one of the things that we've seen, again, in France, we see it in the Investigatory Powers Bill that is being considered in the United Kingdom right now. We've seen it in Spain. We see it probably coming down the pike in Poland. So we're talking about, you know, countries in the European Union that are bound by standards of the European Court of Human Rights, the European Convention of Human Rights. They're undermining encryption. So what is encryption? It's math. So my eyes used to glaze over. Also, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I mean, I went to law, so I wouldn't have to do math anymore. But encryption is actually a fundamental protection for individual privacy, for your communication. I mean, oftentimes, I mean, I ask this question, how many people in the room use encryption? I mean, you could ask. That is a good raising of hands, but actually, probably more hands can go up because encryption is, you know, how you do your mobile banking. It's essential to the internet, essentially. It's essential to protection of, you, unless you have Anthem Blue Cross, it's essential to the protection of your health data, right? So it's actually one of the fundamental protections of, you know, of individual privacy. It's also fundamental to the way we communicate, right? So obviously the FBI, Apple debate of the last, 6 weeks or so has heightened and highlighted the issue. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that as we talk through. But one thing around the world that encryption is important for is the ability of activists, the ability of vulnerable communities to communicate with one another, to create community online. If you're, let's say, you're a minority in a place where the overwhelming majority opinion is against your views, whether it's religious or ethnic or whatnot, having a public space to engage and interact with people is pretty difficult to find. So, or as an example, there was someone wrote a really great paper last year on atheists in the Arab world, right? Atheism in some countries in the Arab world is apostasy and can be, very harshly punished. Individuals who are atheists in the Arab world have tended to use encryption in order to both learn about others who are interested in the same way of thinking about the world, but also just to create community. So toggling back to, the United States and Europe, when we talk about undermining encryption, let's say legitimate purposes of law enforcement, it's also a signal to the rest of the world that encryption isn't that important and that encryption is something that we can undermine for our own purposes. And look, we define national security or public order by different standards than you do, so it creates a risk. And to go back, and this will all end on this point, when I was in Tajikistan a couple of weeks ago on an official mission, I met with some members of the security apparatus, and they were very clear about the models that they look to around the world, right? And the models that they look to tend to be Western, right? And they look to what's happening in Europe. They look to the debate that we're having in the United States over digital security. They say, well, look, you're having this debate. We can also, they don't have real debate. They've been crushing public space. But putting that aside, they basically said directly to me and to my team, we need to take down the internet sometimes. We need to compromise encryption because we have national security concerns and we need to understand what's happening in the country. In truth, they have, infinite number of ways to track issues of terrorism. Terrorism itself isn't even a major threat, in particular in Tajikistan, although they're going to, they talk about the threat on the border with Afghanistan and so forth, but they're looking to us. They're looking to us for models, and I think that particularly in areas of national security, digital security, and so forth, we're doing a poor job of modeling.
Tying that into the debate that we've been having here, particularly in the context of the Apple case, for a significantly long period of time, the United States has developed a balance whereby law enforcement, with the permission of a court, can go and gain access to private information belonging to individuals. They can conduct search and seizures. They can read someone's mail, look up their library records. Yeah. And so I guess the question that law enforcement has been raising is that we've historically had this principle, which is now being surpassed by technology, and whether there's ways that we can both have strong encryption and enable access for law enforcement. And I think the example that law enforcement would give is that until very recently, many of us were carrying cell phones that could be decrypted by the provider, and many of us stored private information on that. But we didn't consider that an unacceptable threat to our privacy or our liberty. And so the question that it raises is whether you believe that there's really any mechanism for lawful government access that does not, at least in theory, create a security vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. So technologically, I think it's very difficult to identify a kind of general way to compromise, digital our devices, basically. So there are different possibilities out there. There's the idea that you've probably heard about creating backdoors into technology, which is basically backdoor, the FBI will tell you that's That's the negative, right? That's a derogatory term for what they ultimately want. And I'm not sure they actually want that anymore. We'll see. But what they, what we're talking about is vulnerabilities in the software so that, you know, that law enforcement can get into those devices. That's exactly right. Now, the problem with that is that, and this is what technologists, as a general rule, will tell you. I don't know technologists who think otherwise, but if you create a vulnerability for law enforcement, that's a vulnerability that will be available to the bad guys as well. It's simply a matter, again, of math. It's a matter of technology, that it's impossible to create a vulnerability that only the good guys have access to. So that's the technological problem, right? I do think, though, that one of the problems in the debate is the idea that only getting access to the content of our devices is important to law enforcement. We live in what people are talk about as a golden age of surveillance, right? There's so many ways that our devices can be tracked, that our private lives can be kind of deduced simply by looking at the metadata. You know, you may be using encryption, and that protects the content of your communication, but it's not protecting you from, you know, being tracked. It's not protecting when you're making phone calls, unless you're using, you know, an encryption service, which very few people do. It doesn't, you know, prevent you from being surveilled in that way. And so there's a real expansion in what law enforcement has access to, even if they don't have access to the content of our communications.
And that's definitely true. I think the point that some law enforcement officials, such as David Bidcour at the Department of Justice, when he was testifying before Congress, made is that there are these more run-of-the-mill type cases. Someone, in this case in Miami, for example, a federal criminal case, a truck driver kidnapped his girlfriend, assaulted her when he was tried. He claimed that it was all consensual, that this was his girlfriend. She said no, she'd been sexually assaulted. He, in fact, had recorded a video on his cell phone that showed her very clearly being assaulted. That was played at the trial, resulted in his conviction. So that although there are many instances in which metadata would allow law enforcement to connect people to crimes, there will be another subset of cases, perhaps not with the most intelligent criminals, but where access to the data stored on the phone itself will be important.
Look, there's no denying that one of the functions of encryption is to protect people from government surveillance. I think that's a good. I believe in privacy. I believe in, particularly in a digital age, that we're increasingly subject to government surveillance. Not always nefarious, but with data retention, it's possible. So it's also important, I think, to acknowledge that there are some downsides to encryption. I mean, there will be cases, I think they're relatively rare, but there will be cases where digital security may undermine law enforcement. We should accept that. To my mind, and this is one of the reasons why we did the report in the first place last year, the debate really framed encryption as solely a negative. Encryption was seen, and you have to go back to about a year and a half ago when James Comey, early on in his tenure at the FBI, started talking about going dark, the going dark problem. To a certain extent, it is a problem, but it's also a question of trade-offs. All public policy is about trade-offs. And so we need to think through, I think, whether in light of those situations that might be problematic from the perspective of law enforcement, whether we want to give up digital security. And what does that mean we lose? And what does that mean not only that we lose, because here, of course, we're talking about you know, us as Americans in the United States, but of course we're also talking about technology companies that are global. So it's not just, there's a sort of an externality here that we don't always take into account, and that is that if we don't take into account the impact that compromising digital security has on people around the world, I think we're doing a real disservice to those people. So it's a question of trade-offs that I think is important for people to acknowledge.
And bringing that into the specific context of the Apple case, which mm-hmm. explored these trade-offs, and your report was really, I think, one of the first to try and set forth a robust legal framework for mm-hmm. analyzing these types of trade-offs. And unfortunately, in the Apple case, just to provide some background, the FBI, with the assistance of a third party, figured out a technological solution that would allow them to access the encrypted contents of the cell phone in question, which belonged to one of the San Bernardino shooters. Mm-hmm. And Apple itself had said that they didn't have the ability to do that. The FBI thought they didn't have the ability to do it either. Tim Cook had said, if we get access or if there's a security vulnerability like this, it will be like cancer. Mm-hmm. And so does the fact that the FBI has now discovered this security vulnerability, are we all at risk now? Mm. Or were those consequences overstated? And should the FBI have to share the nature of that security vulnerability with mm-hmm. Apple?
Mm-hmm. So those are all great questions. We could do another seminar on all those questions. So first off, I don't think that Apple in any way was acting in bad faith in its arguments. I think its principal argument was that in order for us to crack this phone, essentially, it would have to create code. And so it would be compelled to create a vulnerability in their device. And that had both precedential impact, right? So an impact on all those future cases where law enforcement in the United States and abroad would seek to compel some kind of vulnerability in their device, or in a particular device, or in a category of devices. So that was one thing, and I think they were right. That was, I think that was a legitimate argument. Now, they didn't know the vulnerability, and it's important to understand that there's actually a market out there for identifying vulnerabilities, and many tech companies pay top dollar to hackers to, you know, give them vulnerabilities that they identify. So what it sounds like is this case got a huge amount of publicity. And footnote, this is what most technologists said would happen. You get all this publicity, and basically you got some technologists or a tech company. I guess the suggestion is it was an Israeli company
that
identified the flaw and, you know, gave the flaw, sold the flaw, I have no idea, to the FBI, and they were able to open the phone. You know, another footnote query, you know, what they found on the phone. Apparently the couple, you know, destroyed two other phones and left this one alone. So I have my doubts about what was on there, but that's beside the point. But I think what happened in this situation, to my mind, is I hate to frame it as a victory for digital security, but this is how it should work, I think, in terms of not requiring the digital sector, private companies, to undermine the vulnerability of their devices across the board, but to really find ways into particular devices using brute force, as was used here. I do think that if the FBI does not share that vulnerability with Apple, that's tremendous bad faith. Because what that means is, and this doesn't mean for all phones, right? This means for, I think we're talking about the Apple 5C and that particular operating system. And there's been changes in, and I don't hold a brief for Apple, but from what I understand, there's been changes in the security system that Apple uses on its devices now. So whatever was found on the 5C probably doesn't apply in this case, but we don't know. And you know, for the sake of all of our security, all of us who use iPhone 5s, you know, we should have Apple should receive from the FBI that vulnerability.
Do you think that courts will be more skeptical of requests by the government if they ask for third-party assistance from Apple, from Samsung, from other carriers in the future? Because in this case, the government said there was no way to access the phone, and in fact, there apparently was a way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, FBI was very clear in its pleadings, and this, again, this is another reason why I think that there's a sort of victory for digital security here, which is this is all on the record. And what we see out of, and I really encourage people, I mean, to the extent you have time to do this, go back, go and look at some of the briefings, the briefs in this case, because they're really fascinating. But what you see is Apple making a very strong case on the law. And you see the members, you know, different aspects, different elements of the tech sector lining up with Apple and making very strong arguments. And you see, you know, members of civil society, NGOs lining up with Apple in favor of digital security. And then you have the Apple, the FBI briefs. And in those briefs, they were very clear about what they could not do. And I think that was, an unfortunate move on the FBI's part, because most of the claims that they made about their ability to access material, access the device, were not, in fact, accurate. And so I do think that courts, to the extent that it's entered into the record, of course, courts will look twice, think twice about accepting the FBI's claims. I think the FBI will get a tremendous amount of pushback. I think at the state level, because this isn't just about what the FBI is asking, the district attorney of Manhattan, Cyrus Vance Jr., has been pushing for this and did a report actually on this last fall or last summer. So state actors are going to be pushing for access to encrypted devices as well, encrypted communications as well. And I think given the way the debate was framed and the way it kind of unfolded, I think that courts should think twice about it. And there will be, by the way, it's not just courts, there'll be some knockoff effects also. In Congress, there's a bill right now that Congressman Ted Lieu, who's in Southern California, he's one of the few members of Congress with a computer science degree from Stanford. Not that there are other computer science people at Stanford, but anyway, you understand. He and a couple others have a bill to basically preempt state law so that states cannot undermine digital security, you know, through encryption as well.
Do you think it matters whether the FBI has found a software vulnerability or a hardware vulnerability? So what the FBI was originally asking Apple to do was to write a software update for the iPhone, which would disable its auto erase feature. There's an auto erase option on the iPhone where if you enter a password 10 times incorrectly, it erases the key that would be necessary to access the encrypted data. And Apple argued that if they wrote this software for one iPhone, it could escape into the wild, undermining our security generally. And there's been speculation that what the FBI actually found, at least potentially, was a hardware vulnerability, mm-hmm. where they could dump the memory from the phone, from the flash chip on the phone. They could try a few passwords, copy that memory. If they hit the 10 password limit, they'd just copy it over again, try another 10 times, mm-hmm. and keep doing that till they got the right password. Mm-hmm. And are hardware vulnerabilities as dangerous to the public as large as software vulnerabilities? They require physical control of a phone itself, mm-hmm. potentially for a long time. This isn't something a criminal gang is going to do to steal your identity, but something that governments might be able to do in limited situations legally with a warrant approved by a court. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, it's a great question. And I mean, I don't think, since I'm not a technologist, I can't really evaluate sort of the software versus hardware at any real level of, certainly not technological sophistication, but I think the main point that you, I mean, really said nicely is, you know, with the software, it would have been, I mean, again, we don't know yet, but if it was a software vulnerability, then, you know, we're talking about a vulnerability that could apply across other devices. What I'm hearing from most technologists is that it was more likely a hardware vulnerability, and that it was a kind of mirroring of the device's memory and then accessing it in the way that Jacob described it. I find that much less of a concern than the software vulnerability, because it really requires, first of all, it requires a targeted kind of focus on a particular, in a particular law enforcement situation. Now, I still think it has to be in those situations subject to court order. I think those kinds of issues. Now, here we're talking about, let's say, a dead terrorist and his phone, and the FBI or San Bernardino County kind of screwed up in terms of denying themselves access to the uploaded data on iCloud, but that's like a whole another issue. But I think in this particular situation, that if it was a hardware device and if we're talking about court-ordered or court-permitted access to a device, that's much less of a concern than general vulnerability across devices.
And I think another question this raises probably more broadly is in regard to corporate control over our personal data as opposed to government access. So we have a lot of experience striking an appropriate balance between individuals and the government in terms of their privacy rights, but we have much less experience with technology companies as stewards of our personal data. Mm-hmm. You know, we have wearables like Fitbit, smart home devices like Nest, connected cars, the so-called Internet of mm-hmm. Things. These are all creating extensive amounts of data, sometimes about very intimate aspects of our lives. And it seems like there's open questions about what responsibility private companies have, if any, with that
mm-hmm.
data.
Mm-hmm. This is a huge issue. It's actually an issue where I think in some respects, Europe is ahead of us because they have very strict data retention policies, right? So when we think about all of the data that's being collected, the question is, do these companies get to hold on to that data indefinitely? Is there a period of time during which they can hold on to it, but then have to trash it? What are the rules around that? And I think now Europe has a very strong tradition. In part, this is driven by culture and the history of both World War II and the communist era and surveillance, but it's also driven by law in the sense that European human rights law is much stronger in terms of privacy protection. So they've developed a whole set of laws around data protection, precisely to deal with this issue of, what we accept in terms of what the corporate sector retains. We haven't mentioned one name here that I think has been sort of is Edward Snowden's revelations, let's say, has really framed for both Americans but also people around the world what the risks are, and in particular what the risks are when it comes to data retention. So if you have corporate actors retaining all of this data, to what extent will government demand access to that data at some point? Whether, to sort of mine the data to identify security risks in a kind of, needle in a haystack kind of phishing expedition, to what extent can they use that data for purposes of, particular targeted law enforcement or intelligence activities? And I think that, to a great extent, the Snowden revelations really highlighted for people the threat to, in the digital age, right, to privacy in a digital age. And it's been, I think, especially pronounced in Europe. Now, the reality is that, Europeans, and we could say at both the civil society level and the government, were very upset by what Edward Snowden revealed. I mean, unless you were in the UK, where the UK is, if anybody's been to the UK recently, it's already basically a surveillance state. I don't mean that in the Orwellian nature, but every single corner that you're on has a camera when you're in the UK. So data is being collected on you wherever you are. There was a little bit less of an outcry there, in particular because GCHQ, the National Security Agency's partner, was deeply involved in the activities that were revealed by Edward Snowden. Across Europe, though, over the last year or so, we're seeing new laws. And again, I mentioned the French, but we're seeing it in the UK. We're seeing new laws on both undermining data retention policies. We see this potentially happening at the EU level. So these are areas where there was this initial, you know, post-Snowden revelations, June of 2013, of outrage, and yet we see maybe a movement that could undermine digital privacy. I mean, maybe the ultimate part of your question, I think that's really important, is what responsibility do we think the corporate sector owes us as individuals or as users, if we want to be kind of anonymized in that way? What is their responsibility to protect our privacy? What is the responsibility, say, of Google to protect your search history, right? Your search history is you. I mean, it's weird. If you went back and looked at your search history over the last year, I mean, some of it might disappoint you in yourself. But some of it might also, you know, it would probably be it sounds cheesy to say this, but it'd be a little bit of a window into your soul, your curiosities at a given moment. So let's say you're in an environment now, you know, you might feel fine with our current government in the United States, and you don't think they're going to, you know, want access to our search histories, but who knows what that, I mean, and this isn't, you know, sort of, if I raised this a year ago, it might not have seemed as real, but, you know, who knows what the next government might demand of the corporate sector when it comes to sharing simply search history, right? So that, I mean, I think this is a real major issue. I mean, we're launching a project that tries to identify what are corporate sector responsibilities, but I think that it's not, it's one of these open areas where it's unclear where the government might head over the next several years in terms of demanding access, not just to our devices, but to, you know, our very, you know, curiosity.
Sure, and of course, governments can exploit security vulnerabilities to surveil people, their own citizens, mm-hmm. and foreigners. They can use those vulnerabilities to spy on journalists, yeah. engage in mass surveillance. I think you talked about the impact that the United States example could have on the rest of the world. Yeah. Of course, some people would say that whatever the United States does, authoritarian governments, states like China, Russia, will demand access to encrypted data.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that's right. I mean, we can say, well, if we adopt this, then what's to stop, you know, the authoritarian governments? They're going to do it anyway. That to a certain extent, that's true. Interestingly, so China adopted a cybersecurity law earlier this year. And in that law, they actually moved away from original sort of proposals that would have made encryption strong, you know, really quite vulnerable. And who pushed back? Alibaba, you know, basically the e-commerce sector in China pushed back and said, look, if you're going to create vulnerabilities in encryption, that's going to create vulnerabilities for our own ability to conduct commerce. And so it's interesting that the pushback was actually corporate. Mm-hmm. And so I think that to a certain extent, some of the digital security kind of controversies that we have, we'll find some allies in the corporate sector in places where at least it resonates. You know, will it resonate in a place like Russia? So Russia has extensive ability to surveil. They have these devices that are basically, if you're a telecom provider in Russia, by law, you have to accept these devices onto your networks, and those networks just suck up data. And, you know, there's nothing that the corporate actors can do about it. So they're going to get your data regardless. In China, you know, there's bans on using VPNs, on anonymity, on all sorts of other, you know, areas where, you know, encryption is just one of many areas to protect yourself, and it's very hard to protect yourself in that environment. But it doesn't help if the United States and other, you know, liberal democratic states are at the same time really talking about undermining digital security.
So we have a large number of questions from the audience that we're going to start to address now. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to David Kaye, the UN Special Rapporteur, discussing national security, privacy, and freedom of expression online. So the first question we have from the audience is about the role of private companies such as Twitter and Facebook in upholding freedom of speech. So there's been a large controversy over the use of communications mediums such as Twitter for recruiting individuals to ISIL. Some in the government have suggested that the provisions of law which provide for immunity for companies like Facebook or Twitter for materials that third parties post on their platforms should be replaced. Mm-hmm. And what is your view of both the responsibilities of these companies and whether it would be permissible for the government to basically alter the incentives they have to police their own users?
Mm-hmm. God, that's a great question. And it's a complicated question. So let me address it in just a couple of different ways. So one is the sort of the last part of it. And this is about the liability or the immunities that intermediaries have. An intermediary like Twitter, it's an intermediary or Facebook. It's a Twitter because it it's an intermediary because it provides a platform, right, for others to communicate, right? So it's not that Twitter itself is communicating. I mean, if you buy that way of thinking, I mean, that might be something to interrogate also, but, you know, it's not that Twitter is communicating, but it's a mediary, right? It's allowing communication. So from my perspective and from, you know, most U.S. law perspective and law in Europe, generally speaking, intermediaries are immune from liability. They're held to not be liable for the content that's posted on their platforms. And why is that? I mean, it's because, you know, you want to encourage freedom of expression. I mean, these are platforms to encourage it. And to the extent that the intermediary is going to be held liable, they'll restrict the space for expression, right? So there was a case in the European Court of Human Rights that actually held an Estonian media company liable for some of the comments that were posted on the comment section in relation to a story. The story is interesting, but I won't get into it. But what that forces a small media company in Estonia to do is to shut down its comment section. Now, comment sections are crazy, but sometimes they're enlightening, and they're also a place where a lot of people communicate and express themselves. So there are real implications. So that's sort of the background on intermediary liability. So the question is, I think there's a couple of ways of thinking about it in the context of you know, digital intermediaries. So one is in the context of, say, recruitment. And I think it's a problem area. I'm not sure there's a whole lot of concrete recruitment going on. There is some recruitment in which Twitter is used. Most of the data that I've seen about recruitment is that recruitment requires face-to-face interaction in order for recruitment to be effective. But let's even imagine that Twitter or Facebook are real sites for recruitment. I think this is an example of an area where government has a legitimate interest in gaining access to those kinds of communications. It's a totally different question to ask whether an Islamic State kind of group or any other terrorist group should be, how we deal with their posting of, say, videos on, let's say, YouTube, right? So should YouTube be required to take down a beheading video? Should governments be able to require YouTube to take down the video? If they don't take down the video, should they be held liable to some form of damages? And I think it'd be a very interesting conversation to have specifically about that. I think there's an argument that can be made for the public interest value of people seeing these videos. I'm not sure how much recruitment value they have, but there is a public interest, I think, in knowing what's actually happening in these, in the context of what terrorists are doing. So that's an issue. I'm not going to resolve it, here, but I think it's an issue for people to think about in terms of, takedown policies, whether we want the digital actors to be responsible for taking that material down. And I think there are, strong arguments across the spectrum on that issue. I think one thing that we do see, though, quite regularly is that governments are expanding beyond the kind of, you know, the terrorist, the beheading videos that need to be taken down, which I think you could make a lot of good arguments about why they should be taken down. But in places around the world, you see governments demanding of, you know, Twitter, Facebook, and also local, you know, domestic social media and search engines, really demanding the takedown of material that doesn't fall into the category of, you know, like a beheading, right? It could be, so for example, in Turkey, there have been a couple of really terrible terrorist attacks in the last few weeks. And the government brought down Twitter, I mean, brought down the whole service, but also regularly demands the taking down of, you know, video that shows the terrorist attack or the aftermath of the attack. And I'm not quite sure that falls into the same category of terrorist recruitment. Now, it might. You might be able to make the argument, but these are issues of public interest, and we're seeing takedowns quite regularly. And we're seeing that expand into, and again, this is Turkey. It's a very unfortunate case right now where the move is to criminalize journalists for reporting on terrorism. So to a certain extent, there's, if we could narrow it to particular kinds of recruitment or videos, okay, fine, we could do that. But to the extent it expands to all the way to journalism and to academics in places like Turkey, I think we're running some very serious risks.
And in terms of those sort of expansions of national security exemptions or justifications, a member of the audience asks, what effect on those does the current Supreme Court vacancy have? What would a Garland appointment mean? And I will add, because you referenced this earlier, what would a Trump or Cruz administration mean for these types of issues?
I think Cruz would carpet bomb the internet, is my understanding. So, you know, it's. I think actually I can't game out the Supreme Court. It's very hard because digital security, I actually think my understanding, and I'm not an expert on Merrick Garland, but my understanding is that one of the things where he really made an imprint on the D.C. Circuit was access to information. Right, so he opened up the D.C. Circuit to cameras, to video, which is, you know, the Supreme Court has been resisting, you know, for more than a generation. And so maybe I'd like to imagine that he would be, because digital security is about and can be framed as centrally about access to information, that he would be friendly to access to information. But I don't know where the other eight members of the court fall on these issues. They, you know, there might be some odd coalitions that develop around that.
Sure, yet to be seen. This next question, I think, is more individual about what can we do as private citizens to avoid the loss of anonymous communication, anonymous search history. This person asks, even though the majority of people use can opt out of certain activities and avoid surveillance by restricting the browser they use, mm-hmm. et cetera, with technological developments such as closed circuit cameras, facial recognition, things of this nature, isn't it essentially inevitable that we'll have some constraint on our privacy? And it, you know, in fact, reminds me of Mark Zuckerberg said that privacy was no longer a social norm. Mm-hmm. And so in light of comments like that of, you know, the world's biggest social networking, you know, sharing platform, mm-hmm. What can we do as individuals?
Another really great question. So I don't want to be a downer about it. A reporter formerly with the Wall Street Journal, who's now with ProPublica, I think, Julia Angwin, wrote a book called Dragnet Nation a couple of years ago. And in it, she documents how she tried basically to go off the grid to protect her privacy and her family's privacy. And it was impossible. And I think that, you know, we have ourselves to blame, right? Because we've bought into the business model that, you know, we'll sell our private data essentially to the corporate sector in return for this unbelievable access to information. I mean, we have the greatest access to information of any, you know, group of people in human history. That's not overstating. It is the truth. So that's the trade-off that we've made. And in that sense, I'm not sure there's that much we can do about it, but are there things you can do individually to protect yourself? I think there are. I mean, I'll name a few of them. So one is, I would say, encourage in whatever, maybe it means buying devices, maybe it means using different platforms, but encourage the corporate sector to adopt privacy-enhancing tools. So I think, like I said before, I have no brief for Apple or anything, but I think the move to default encryption on iMessage is really valuable and is something that we want to encourage across platforms, across devices. So I don't mean to say go out and buy an Apple product, but whatever you do use, you know, to the extent you can, encourage that, you know, adoption of that kind of technology as a default. And, you know, we can tell the corporate sector what we want by what we purchase. So that's one possibility. A second is you don't have to use Google. I know I've tried it. I still use Google. And Google is a pretty good actor on a lot of bases. I'm not criticizing Google here, but to the extent that you're concerned about your search history being in the hands of a corporate actor, there are other tools out there. There are other search engines. DuckDuckGo is one of them. It's actually a pretty good search engine. I think it's pretty useful, and they don't retain any of your search history. So that's one possibility. The other is you should check when you browse so if you have Chrome or Firefox, other devices, you know, you can tell if you're at a secure website. So the easiest way is to see the URL is HTTPS. That means it's an encrypted connection. Pretty much any banking that you do online, or, you know, your personal health data, let's say, is going to be with an HTTPS URL up there, and that means that you're more or less protected. You should check that, and if you're on websites that aren't secure, you know, talk to the administrator, particularly if it's like maybe your company or wherever you work, to do that, to upgrade to secure communication. The last thing I would say is use encryption yourself. So one of the problems with encryption around the world is that governments will say, oh, you're using this form of public key encryption. You must be trying to hide something. So one thing that we can do in order to, you know, you don't have to give money. You don't have to, you know, go to a country and actually do something, but you could use encryption in your own, you know, encourage your friends and use encryption. And we don't have enough time to have, call like a crypto party where we would all, you know, get encrypted. But to the extent that more and more people use encryption as a part of their daily interaction, their daily communication, it creates kind of a cloud, so that those who are using encryption really to protect themselves as activists are more protected, right? There's safety in numbers. So, you know, you can go, if you want to learn how to get encrypted, you know, Electronic Frontier Foundation is here in San Francisco. You can go to EFF, go to their website and learn how to encrypt yourself. There are other, you know, sort of, you know, security in a box tools that you can find online to do this kind of thing. And I would encourage people to do it. That's something that you can do, you know, in 20 minutes when you get home.
And so with the overall view being that it's relatively difficult to restrict the crumbs of identifying information and preferences that you leave online, I know there's a recent report published by the Harvard Berkman Center for the Internet and Society, and it ultimately concluded that this going dark debate, the debate over encrypting our phones, is ultimately not as important as the technological developments that are occurring in other areas. So that even if law enforcement can't get access to certain types of data that's stored on phones, that will be more than offset by the ability of U.S. law enforcement agencies to exploit the comparatively weak security of sensors, connected devices, data in transmission, as this is ultimately or will ultimately be the subject of a legislative debate here in Congress over what the appropriate access should be for law enforcement. Are you of the view that the government should essentially accept the loss of information in these types of cases where there's data relevant to a criminal investigation stored physically on the phone, because overall the technological developments are creating more information that benefit law enforcement?
Yeah, so I wouldn't frame it as losing access to information. I would say not getting as much information as they otherwise would get, because I know that sounds like a lawyerly semantic thing, but the truth is law enforcement has access, as we were talking about before, has access to a tremendous amount of information. And I don't think there's, I think, you know, what we're talking about is a relatively narrow set of information, at least if we're talking about Apple FBI, right, about our communications. But it's going to be very, very difficult. I mean, maybe over the long term this will happen, but to deny the government access to metadata and other tools that they have in this, in an age of surveillance. So I think that Congress should be legislating to protect digital security. And maybe a point that I didn't hit hard enough at the beginning was, you know, individual digital security is national security. I mean, our ability to protect ourselves, our ability to protect our networks, to protect our infrastructure, that's a core national security issue right now. And so, you know, it's easy for government to frame national security or public order as only about terrorism or child pornography and kidnappings and so forth. But security is much broader. And in a digital age, if we're going to talk about protecting ourselves, whether it's from hackers, whether it's from terrorists, we have to, at the very least, you know, protect our own digital security. And so, I mean, my hope is that, you know, with people like Congressman Liu and others, that there actually will be momentum for, and actually I think this will happen, that it won't just be liberal Democrats like Ted Liu, but also conservative Republicans who believe in small government and government not having access to our individual lives, that there can be a kind of new coalition around digital security. And I think that's possible.
And in the interim, we've heard Cyrus Vance has said that that New York, the state authorities there, have, I think, scores of iPhones that they'd like to crack. I heard there's around at least a dozen other cases similar to the San Bernardino case proceeding across the country now. Obviously, we have Congress in an election year, probably not disposed to address these thorny issues. What should courts be doing in the absence of legislative action to resolve this really sharp dispute?
Yeah. So FBI has been relying on the All Writs Act, right? So they've been relying on this act from, you know, the first Congress, I mean, literally the first Congress, that provides a kind of fail-safe for access to all sorts of information. And it's just not appropriate. It's not an appropriate tool as a matter of law for the government to use, in my view. And so I think that in the interim, courts should be denying the government the ability to use the All Writs Act. I mean, here we're narrowly just talking about U.S. law, but they should be denying the government the right to use that as a tool to gain access to information. If that means denying them access in particular situations, I think that's clearly something Congress is going to have to resolve. I don't think it's going to destroy law enforcement to do that. It will make law enforcement's job harder, though.
And similarly, across the world, from a global perspective, there's a lack of consensus in legislative bodies. What should courts be doing in other countries that have different balances between privacy and national security than we do here?
Yeah, they should be doing the same thing, right? They should be, so So actually, the issue of balance is an interesting, I don't like the word balance. I think that when we talk, because we talk about balance, it, to my mind, it leaves a lot of discretion in governments to do the weighing themselves, right? To say, well, I've got freedom of expression here and privacy here, and then I've got, you know, security over here. Which one is more important to me as a judge or as a legislator? And I think what we want to be encouraging governments around the world to do is to apply law, right? And law shouldn't be about discretion. It should be about, these are the freedoms that we enjoy. These are the legitimate restrictions on those rights. And governments can only apply those restrictions if they meet a certain threshold, right? Like I was saying before, there's some existing law, and in order to restrict expression or privacy, it's necessary to protect a particular interest. To my mind, that's not a balance. That's applying the rule of law to understanding, you know, whether it's legitimately necessary to take a particular step. And I think that when it comes to encryption and other forms of digital security, the government mostly will fail that test.
And unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. It uses the word that you don't like, balance.
Yeah.
And it's a question about reconciling, perhaps, mm-hmm. the legitimate means of the government and freedom of expression. And I think, you know, right now we're sort of at an early stage at this debate, but we can easily envision a future, perhaps not that far away, where it is in fact technologically infeasible for either Apple or the government or a third party mm-hmm. to crack an iPhone and get access to data there. And so what then?
We should celebrate. So I think... I do genuinely think that that's something to celebrate or to at least welcome, because, you know, as we've been talking about, there's just so many ways for government to surveil, to get access to our private lives. And so if we can carve out some area of privacy for our communications, at least, and for our search and so forth, I think that's a real value. And to the extent that the corporate sector provides that to us, you know, more power to them, more power to us. I do think, I mean, I should maybe acknowledge this because I don't want to sound like I'm strident, although, I mean, I want to sound a little strident. You know, it's going to be up to lawmakers to conduct that balance, right? For them to reconcile issues of privacy and freedom of expression. In the context of courts, where the balance issue, where you were asking the balance, I don't think balance is the right thing because I don't think courts are really in the position to balance rights. They're in the position to adjudicate disputes and identify and interpret restrictions. It's going to be important for Congress to identify where to reconcile privacy and freedom of expression on the one hand and security on the other. And I think that's where, I mean, to go back to the last question, where, you know, when we can think about what we can do, I think it is, I mean, it just goes back to old school, letting our members of Congress know what we care about. Part of it is, you know, what we're purchasing, but part of it is also engaging in the political process, which, I mean, I would agree that it's easy to be cynical about our political process right now, but I do think it's an area where if we're talking about real legislation, if we're talking about efforts in Congress either to support or undermine digital security, that people in Congress are going to need to hear from us about what we care about. Whether you think, maybe you think that privacy isn't as important, you know, in the way that I've been talking about, and that's totally fair also, but we should be participating and letting members of Congress know our views.
Our thanks to David Kaye for his comments here today. I'm Jacob Foster, and on behalf of the Commonwealth Club, we'd like to thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.